When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, welcome back to .NET Rocks. This is Carl Franklin.
And this is Richard Campbell.
And we're live on Bullhorn again.
Woo!
If you haven't heard about Bullhorn, this is the way that we like to show you what happens behind the scenes when we record a podcast. And for everybody who's subscribed to us on Bullhorn, you get to watch the video and interact with chat.
Yeah, sometimes.
And maybe even answer a poll or something.
Gets a few good questions in. It has been a while since we've done a show.
It really has.
June was the last time we did shows, and now it's the end of July.
Yeah.
We happen to be recording on a Thursday, which is when Eli Holderness's show is being published, which we recorded in May, because time shifting is hard.
The time shifting is hard.
But anyway, it's good to be back in the saddle, huh?
Yeah, and it's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. We get to do that on Bullhorn. I turned 55. You've got another couple of weeks before it happens to you.
That's right. I sent you my happy birthday video. It's got a lot of legs, doesn't it?
It does. It works.
I'm going to send to you every year.
Yeah. Well, you know.
You're going to be 90 and you're going to see that video.
Man, another 40 years of life. I don't even know what I'd do with myself.
And now everybody, I think, wants to know what that video is. Maybe we can put it in the show notes.
I'll send a link in the show notes for sure.
All right, cool. Well, our good friend Rocky Lotka is here. But before we bring him on, let's do a little business. This is Better Know a Framework. Roll the music.
All right, buddy, what do you got?
All right, well, my topic today is a Blazor Train topic.
Nice.
So you can go to blazortrain.com. You can sort descending and you'll see Blazor Canvas is episode 85 that I published July 27th.
Mm-hmm.
But if you follow the link on the page, that'll take you to github.com/Carl Franklin/Blazor Canvas. So what this is it's an amalgamation of tools and demos and code that I wrote.
Cool.
So everybody knows what a canvas is, right? And if you've done any JavaScript programming against the canvas, I want to hire you. No, this is, it's hard. And there's
it is hard.
Yeah, there's some great demos out there about how to do, you know, canvas programming and animation in particular. And there's also this Blazor Extensions canvas component that's out there in Blazor mm-hmm. Extensions. And it gives you a canvas component for Blazor. But what it doesn't do is go the extra mile to do animation. It's just a canvas. You still have to do animation. And the way to do animation in JavaScript is you have to request the time slice in which you want to draw or render a frame.
Okay.
And you do that with window.requestAnimationFrame. And that is a callback to your code that's going to do the drawing with the canvas. So there's a really great demo out there by Scott Hardin.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all in the repo. If you go to my Blazor Canvas repo, the links. Scott Hardin did this excellent blog post, Draw Animated Graphics in the Browser with Blazor WebAssembly. He uses that Blazor Extensions canvas thing, and he also adds some JavaScript to handle that, you know, the frame stuff, right? But that's JavaScript. And right. I wanted to create a wrapper around that stuff so that the Blazor developer never has to touch JavaScript. So I made this thing called AVN Canvas Helper. And that is just a component that has a render fragment as a child content, right? And it has five events. It has canvas resized, which happens when the browser and therefore the canvas gets resized. Mm-hmm. Has a render frame event, and it passes a frames per second value. So you can, you know, show that and figure out what your FPS is. It has a mouse down, a mouse up, and a mouse move event that encapsulates all the stuff from the mouse event that you get in JavaScript. You know, whether button was pressed, which button was pressed, the X and Y, and all of that stuff. So it's pretty helpful because you don't have to do any JavaScript, number one. And number two, you just handle the event and Bob's your uncle. So I took the demo code to do the animation from Scott W. Harden's blog post, and I rewrote it using this AVN Canvas helper. So no JavaScript.
Nice.
And it's all free. It's all OSS and know it, learn it, love it. And check out blazortrain.com if you haven't already.
Good one, man.
That's what I got.
Bouncing ball demos. I love it. It's old, super old school.
Right. Bouncing balls.
All those awaits seem odd, but I guess it's like everything is asynchronous.
Yeah. And I'm not so sure how asynchronous it should be, you know, especially Blazor. You might have better luck if you don't do any kind of asynchronous stuff.
It'd be interesting to play with that. Yeah. All right. Cool.
That's what I got. Who's talking to us, Richard?
Grabbed a comment off of show 1744, the one we did back in June 2021 with Rocky, back when he had a real job, called Open Source in the Enterprise. That was the name of the show. We talked about that whole, did I say that? I said that. Okay. We talked about using open source libraries in the enterprise and sort of the issues around, you know, protecting your code and so on. Got a lot of good comments on the show, which is pretty normal for Rocky shows, to be honest.
Yeah.
And Rob Garner says, and admittedly this is a year ago now, he says, as usual, an excellent and thought-provoking show. During the discussion about the cost and impact of upgrading new versions of a framework or library, it occurred to me that maybe the way we should organize frameworks is a violation of the open close principle. Ideally, a new upgrade to a framework should never break your existing code. However, how often do you upgrade frameworks and then have to go through and review your entire code base?
Yeah.
If we think about how object-oriented design should work, the open-close principle dictates that you never change the original class. Instead, you inherit from and add your changes to the new class and thereby make everything slower. this is harder to do when you're working off an entire framework of libraries. However, couldn't we fix it by adding version numbers into the namespace, which they're there? That way you could import the new version of the framework side by side with the old version and then only worry about the classes you're working on, since only the import statement in that class would reference the new version of the framework. This is actually a very interesting idea.
It is an interesting idea.
Right. The idea that, that you could, because we are allowed side by side operation now, but there's always this implicit, you use the latest version that's loaded. So you can certainly do different versions in different DLLs, but what could you do literally a method by method declaration of run this in this version, run that in that version, and thereby protect your code? I think we'll put it in front of David Fowler and watch his head explode. It'll be great.
That would be awesome.
Rob, you're awesome. Thanks so much for your comment. And a copy of Music to Code By is on its way to you. And if you'd like a copy of Music to Code By, write a comment on the website at .NETROCKS.com or on the Facebooks. We publish every show there. And if you comment there and I read it on the show, we'll send you a copy of Music to Code By.
And definitely follow us on Twitter. I'm at Carl Franklin. He's at Rocky Lotka. And when you send a tweet, you can use a timer. You don't have to request an animation frame.
Are you sure he's at Rocky Lotka?
Yeah. I don't know. Are you? Are you at Rocky Lotka?
He is at Rocky Lotka.
All right. He's at Rich Campbell. I'm at Carl Franklin. And Rocky's at Rocky Lotka. So send us a tweet and mazel tov.
Let's bring in our co-host.
Yeah, let's bring in our co-host. So Rocky has a new, to us, a new bio. He's no longer at Magenic. He is Chief Software Architect at Marimer LLC and is the creator of the open source CSLA.net development framework, of course, author of numerous books and regularly speaks at major conferences around the world. He's a member of the Microsoft Regional Director and MVP programs. And for further information on Rocky, go to lotka.net, LHOTKA.net. Welcome back, Guy.
Hey, it's great to be here again.
Great to have you.
Yeah. What have you been up to? Good Lord. I think as soon as I saw your post about, hey, I'm changing my career around here and leaving Magenic, I messaged you and said, well, that's a show.
After like 22 years of being at one place, it's a big shift.
No kidding. So
what happened?
Yeah. What prompted that?
Well, Magenic got purchased by a bigger company. In fact, a massively huge company. And so I stayed with that for a period of time to help folks transition, hopefully. But it turns out it was not for me. It was in my career, actually, I've never until that point worked for a mega corporation.
Yeah, I think was it Cognizant that bought Magenic?
Yep.
All right, let's talk about them.
Well, I didn't need to do that, but you're now talking about a publicly traded, like, massive company. Like, that's a very different beast.
Yeah. Over 300,000 employees. I mean, that's and I have worked for publicly traded companies, but never close to that size. I mean, as a consultant, I have, but, you know, not as an employee. And there's a big difference between those two. So.
Well, Magenic was really, really good for you in your career. I mean, they let you basically have your talks and your books and stuff. And it really, you know, was good for them, I'm sure. It was a great relationship, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a fantastic relationship. Yeah, it was very mutually beneficial because, like you say, they not only allowed but encouraged. It was literally part of my job to be working on open source and speaking and writing. And
from the very beginning, too. And that was very forward thinking on their part. That was before, blogs and celebrities and stuff where it was a thing.
Right. Yeah. That was, it was the year 2000 is when I joined. So it was, early thinking. And the company I worked for prior to that, where I, had started writing and speaking, was like, you can moonlight like that. That's okay. It's not a violation of your contract, but do it on your own time. Take vacation when you go speak. Mm. And we're not supporting you in any way, but boy, we'll reap the benefits.
And, right.
Yeah, sure.
And so.
Not so much.
So obviously Magenic was a pretty obvious choice for me because they recognized the value. Gained the value over the years, both in terms of generating recruiting notoriety, I guess. Or I don't know. A lot of people came to work for Magenic because they heard about Magenic through me, or were like, "Yay! I can go work for the place that Rocky works for." And it had a sales impact too, where obviously we opened a lot of doors and had a lot of really fantastic conversations with prospective customers, based on a lot of the things that I had been doing in the public sphere.
So your new venture is yours and yours alone, right? Or are you working for another company?
No, I'm working completely for myself right now. I'm very early in this process. So, but so far I'm enjoying it. I like my new boss.
I don't know about that guy. He doesn't understand Moore's Law at all.
I think you're talking about your wife, Teresa, right?
Boss. But luckily I like that boss too. So it's all good.
What is Marimer? Awesome. What's the significance of that word?
Well, I was sitting, living in Minnesota. I was sitting out in the woods, watching nature flow by, thinking about company names. And so I decided to take the syllables from Teresa and Timothy and Marcus, my kids, and, just was sitting there rearranging syllables and came up with, cool. There's obviously a lot of combinations, but this is the one I settled on. So,
yeah, it's pretty cool. I like that. It's like Desilu.
Yeah, right.
Fabricating all the words together. So just a little, you have a particular gig in mind, or is just, I need a wrapper over myself to do some stuff?
I actually created the LLC quite a few years ago because somebody wanted to use CSLA, but they couldn't use it if it wasn't, if, you know, basically it had to have a company behind it.
Right.
And, even though it's open source, it, I don't know. I didn't understand it, but I'm sure their lawyers.
It made them happy.
And so, and actually it was a customer of Magenix at the time. And so Magenix paid the really quite small fee to create the LLC. And, so the LLC has really been, existed all these years as the vehicle for CSLA and anything related to it.
Yeah.
So now I'm just potentially expanding it. You know, so if somebody, wants to, you know, have me do some consulting or whatever, then, I'm good with that. So far, yeah, everything I've been doing is still focused on writing and speaking at conferences and, working on enhancing CSLA to work with, you know, Maui and do some other cool stuff. So
very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes total sense to do that. But is it just a big corporation thing that puts you off? Like, was your job going to change that much? I make sense to me in an acquisition and the company changed, like, now is the time to rethink your career. Right. Like that makes a lot of sense to me, but, I just wonder about how different your job was going to be in the bigger company.
Yeah. Well, I think it's two things, Richard. You know, one is this doing what I'm doing right now is the culmination of a long plan, many, many years that I've been, you know, planning on doing exactly what I'm doing now. And the timing, you know, it was either just when Magenix got purchased, you know, call it at that point, or stick with, Cognizant and, you know, explore the opportunity. And so I chose the latter because, like I said, I'd never worked for a big company. And the way that the acquisition was framed is that, we were actually being bought by a small division within Cognizant that was trying to, be more like Magenix. Yeah, 'cause when you think of Cognizant, you probably don't think of small agile boutique, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's a very big company and they're like, hey, but we want to capture that, you know, kind of mindset. And, so I'm like, hey, that sounds pretty cool. Right. And interesting. And they may yet succeed. I wouldn't go, you know, put money on it one way or another, but, creating an exciting tech focused culture, in a small company or I don't know if you'd call Magenix small, but having that kind of impact is a lot easier than trying to carve it out in a big company with a very established, culture that is very much focused on, at Magenix, our focus was largely on newer technologies because that's generally what our employees considered to be cool and fun. And, you know, Cognizant's like Fortran, COBOL. Yeah, we like those. Those are good technologies.
they make them money, right?
Very profitable. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, so it was a real, it wasn't just my fight, right? I mean, the people leading this little group inside of Cognizant, have their work cut out for them trying to, change the parent company's, you know, kind of culture or worldview to say, yeah, actually having a group that's focused on new stuff,
is a good idea. And it is an interesting debate here of, do you need to have a lot of experience inside of the organization to be able to navigate the quote unquote rocks and shoals of an existing company to carve that space out for you? Or does being the new guy actually give you the advantage to try and build something like that? I think it's a hard call.
I think it is. I had a lot of hopes that being the new guy would give me an advantage. And for some people it would, my particular, skill set and approach to things, I crashed on those rocks and shoals, you know, and, And so I do think that somebody who had worked for a long time in a big company and was used to identifying the myriad levers of power that you don't see but are out there, might have had some. Basically, I'm used to a world where the decision makers all get in a room, figure out. And sometimes it's acrimonious, but you hash out what you're going to do and then you go out and do it. And
right.
Boy, that's not the same with these big companies, I guess.
Well, and there's lies the real trap is you said decision makers, and from working with clients, like if the decision maker's not in the room, what are we doing? And I think it's a very challenging part of a big company to actually figure out, are the right people in the room? And you only find out after the fact. You make a plan. You go to proceed on the plan and find out, oh, no, there was a key person that wasn't there, and they do not agree, and you're stopped.
Yes. There you have it. Yep.
So, Rocky, you came from a position where you were not only well-known for writing books and doing speaking and conferences and social media and all that stuff, but on top of that, what you wrote was really good. So the world at large knows about how good a software writer you are and a technical writer. People who want to strike out on their own from a company may not have that advantage. That's a nice little springboard for you to go from Magenic to your own company. And we've suggested over the years to our listeners, hey, pick an open source project, start contributing to it. You don't have to be a YouTube star. You don't have to write blog posts every day, but if you just get a good reputation for, doing great pull requests and actually helping and contributing to projects, then you have you're essentially sowing the seeds of your own future, aren't you? And has that advice changed? Should we be giving different advice in 2022 to people, or is that still the best example of how to, raise your value in the greater world?
Yeah, I it's an interesting question because I follow a lot of this on Twitter and other social media forums, LinkedIn and whatnot. And there's a lot of discussion and a lot of viewpoints about, certifications are the way to go, or building your portfolio on GitHub is the way to go. And following the traditional, do a good job and get references at one employer to, get you future jobs.
Yeah.
I think all of those remain valid from what I can see. Just thinking from a Magenic perspective and the way that our recruiting staff worked, really focused on LinkedIn. And so I think you can't, and as far as I can tell, that's still, for most recruiters, LinkedIn is the primary place they start and do, because they buy the recruiter package from LinkedIn. So they have access to, do queries and searches and so they are searching through everybody's profiles. And so having a good LinkedIn profile, I just think is, and that LinkedIn profile, can include certifications, and our recruiters would definitely look for certifications.
Right.
And obviously job experience, via LinkedIn, I don't know that our recruiters actually focus that much on like GitHub contributions, but certainly after you get into the interview process, our technical interviewers did, because they're like, oh, I can, I can see that you're an active person who seems well liked, or
can work with others, right? I mean, anybody who's contributing others, successfully to BidHub definitely is showing their ability to collaborate.
I think you talked about certifications. I think that was important in the 90s before the advent of internet searches and being able to, blogs and stuff like that. That was really the only way you could prove your competence other than, sharing source code, which nobody wanted to do. There wasn't any real open source to speak of. But certifications, and guys like Patrick Hines got hundreds of them, mm-hmm. you know, and that really was good for his career back then. And I'm not so sure that that's necessary now, but I like where this conversation's going though.
I look at it though, Carl, like it's a two phase thing. Phase one is you have to have a recruiter find you and approach you. And I think certifications help with that. And having a LinkedIn profile that has the the right buzzwords, right?
Yeah, you know,
but then you have to get through the interview process, and that, you know, some of that is interviewing for personality fit, and you know, is the team actually going to work with you, and so, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But part of it is, and you hear about this, especially apparently the big tech companies all do those whiteboard or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, that was my question. How do you feel about the whiteboard thing? Because it seems like a meme now.
It sure does. I've never understood it because I've always been able to have a 45-minute conversation with somebody and figure out if they actually know what they're talking about.
Right.
And that's how Magenic did it too. We had, you know, senior principal consultants, architects, you know, folks at the top of their game that would be tech interviewers. And we would trust those tech interviewers to have a conversation and figure out, you know, does the prospective person actually know what they're talking about? And I think that's where being able to concretely point back to either work you've done at a previous employer, or point at things you've done in the public space in GitHub and say, I did this. This is how, this is why, and being able to really talk about it. That's what gets you through that technical interview. So that's like phase two, right?
I think they're really bad whiteboard tests. Like, I like the idea of being able to watch you think through a problem on a whiteboard, but writing code on a whiteboard just seems daft.
Right. Totally.
Draw circles and arrows. Back in the pre-GitHub days, like what I like about, let me see what you've been doing on GitHub. I'm not saying it's a requirement, but it does show me you work with others, the kinds of code you've written. But before all of that, I would ask for, bring me your favorite piece of code.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I never said like that you wrote, just what your favorite piece of code is, and then talk to me about it. Because I'm interested in what interests you. Like, you know, why do you like this? What do you know about it? Plus, if I'm looking at that piece of code, like, do you understand it? Mm-hmm. Like, can I get my head around it? I'm always looking for a conversation about code.
Yep.
To just get into how they think.
I've been BS'd by those kinds of things, though.
Oh, sure.
Somebody brought some code and was really good at explaining it. And then I asked them to write a simple loop or something and they couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But so
you got to do both.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I don't know that lots of people have a problem writing code while being scrutinized. Like, that's just,
that
people know.
Kind of pressure is, and it's not normal,
yeah,
right?
But I mean, if you don't know how to write a for loop and you're struggling with that and then say, I can't do this, that's a pretty good sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I also think, like, you do have a portal dev environment. How do you like to work? I just don't have a tough problem. I just did an interview over on RunAs talking about learning PowerShell. And it's like, listen, when I'm going to write a chunk of PowerShell, because I don't write PowerShell every day, I search first.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I search on the problem I'm trying to solve, not necessarily a particular piece of PowerShell.
Right.
But I search into the PowerShell community because I don't have the ego to think what I'm doing is no one else has ever done before. I'm pretty sure somebody else solved this problem.
Right.
And I'd like to see how they solved it. Not that I necessarily want to cut and paste their code, but that I want to see how they approached it. There's most languages have more than one way to solve a problem. And so it's like, well, how did this guy approach this problem? Take his piece of code apart, say, well, this was the key statement. Do I understand this statement? And when I can watch someone go through that process themselves, it tells me a lot about who they are as a developer.
But, you know, back when books were a big thing.
Books? Wait a minute. What?
but I would do that too. I'd go to the bookstore. I'd get another antiquated idea, but I would go to the bookstore and page through books. More often than not, actually, I would buy a book because it had one page that might even have, like you said, one line of code or one little thing
that wows you.
It's like, wow, that is, yeah, yeah. I don't care. The rest of the book may or may not be any good, but this little thing on this one page paid for the book all by itself.
It's worth $50. The price, yep, you know, the price, right, of a book and a DVD. I mean, same with a conference, right? Like if one good idea comes out of a session, you're like, I'm good. That's it, right? I got one idea. I know how much that's going to save me. It's very compelling. It just speaks to the leverage that we have in computing, that one good idea is worth that much.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And folks, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message.
Hey, it's Carl and Richard here. We're here with our friend JD Trask from Raygun.
Hey, JD.
Howdy.
We thought we'd just talk to you for a second about how Raygun got started. How did the whole thing come together?
It wasn't our first product. We actually built a range of different tech companies prior to launching Raygun. And we built Raygun off the back of how Jeremy and I, the JB of the JD-JB duo, had been monitoring our software previously, where we would email ourselves if there was a fault. And we wanted to build a full system around that.
Who would do that? I guess I have.
It's a nightmare going all into your inbox. So that was the inspiration.
Yeah.
That's a great story. And it's a great product. Thanks for making it.
Oh, no. No, it's our pleasure. I honestly think, you know, if I was building a business today, putting something like that in from the get-go, we see customers where they adopt that sort of technology early and the number of issues they have sort of stays very, very low, you know, from the get-go. It's really impressive when you see really large companies that are actually not sending very many errors because they've taken that quality so seriously from the beginning, right, as well as helping larger companies sort of, you know, bring those numbers down and lower the number of faults. It's really cool to see.
Well, we use Raygun at .NetRocks.com. And it does its job. It tells us when there are errors, but we haven't really fixed them yet. So
we do have a permanently ignore function for you there, Carl.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. Well, thanks. Let's do this again.
Thank you.
All right. And if you'd like to know more about Raygun, go to raygun.com and try out a free trial.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we're back. It's .NET Rocks. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Carl Franklin.
Hey.
Talking to our friend Rocky Laca about his career change after 20-something years. I'm not going to say this is a midlife crisis, Rocky. I don't think it is. You don't seem to be in crisis in any way.
No.
But you're in your 50s just like we are. And I think there's sort of a point where you go, there were things I wanted to do. And if I don't do them now, I'm not going to do them.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And I don't know, my intent is that I'm, you know, hopefully in a position where I can focus on the things I truly enjoy.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, you know, at some point work is work because, you know, you have to follow through on things and some parts of anything are not the funnest part, but there's still a big difference between getting involved in initiatives that you know from the outset are not going to be fun, but you're getting paid, versus having the luxury of saying, yeah, that doesn't sound interesting to me, so I'm going to pass. Right.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
right.
I'm sure you can find somebody to do that. It's just not going to be me.
Yeah. And on the flip side is the, you know, boy, that, you know, may or may not be lucrative. It may or may not work out, but it really sounds like fun.
Yeah.
And I would like to invest some time and energy into that because that sounds like fun.
Let's just speak to the progress of a career. I think in the early days of a career, you're trying to do some things to, you know, sort of prove yourself, stress your own skills. You know, can I make that? Can I build that piece? Maybe, you know, just making a contribution to a production product is something. Then you grow to a point where you lead a production product. But that, after a while, I felt like the code I was writing was nowhere near as important to me as helping others write good code.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And,
yep.
Which I think is an interesting change. But then there's this, I think there's a level past that where it's like, hey, there's a bunch of stuff I'm good at that's even valuable, but not that important to me. And there's a bunch of stuff that is important to me, and it may or may not be valuable to others, and I may or may not be good at it, but I still want to do it.
Yes.
Right.
Nope. Well, and that's, I guess, in my career, like you said, you start out kind of, at least back when I started, I was just happy to have a job.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to, early on even learn how to work in CubeLand,
right.
Cause, college doesn't teach you how to show up every day all the basic skills that you learn in that first year or two of just having an office job. At least growing up in rural Minnesota did not prepare me for that.
Sure.
But then like you said, then it changes and it's like, okay, so now I'm pretty good at this and I want to impact, the project I'm working on or the group I'm working with. And how do I, do I do that by becoming a better manager supervisor or mm-hmm. do I do that by becoming a software, like a tech lead or an architect or, mm-hmm. Those are different career paths that
people
choose probably mostly unintentionally early in their career. In my case, I was always and to this day, I just love the technology. So,
right.
And
you tend to be more the mentoring role than the management of a team role. Like you were an architect type that helped others be successful.
Yeah. I think chicken or the egg, right? Yes. Right. My skill set works better for that, for the mentoring mm-hmm. Hopefully gently leading people in a good direction.
Because you're not a jerk, right? And you kind of have to be a jerk if you're leading a team. Sometimes you got to pull a Gordon Ramsay, And
it's true.
What is that?
Well, and often the demands of management don't require you to be a mean person, but to express in certain ways. Like I have literally said, would it help if I smack the table? Because I can.
right. Well, having been in management off and on over my career, there's constraints that come with that too, right?
Sure.
It's like as a group, your peers, your leadership team, whatever, says, okay, this is the direction we're going to go, but here's how we need to frame it so that it is for the betterment of the entire employee base, for the customer. Now they may or may not be right, but this is the, as a team, you set out and say, okay, this is how we're going to frame it. And you're like, I wouldn't frame it that way. But it's not my call. And so, you give up some of that autonomy, to be part of a management team. And, that often makes you look like a jerk.
So I prefer the Rocky you became.
Well, thank you.
Always have. Thank you for not being a jerk.
But you're still going to be up against, now you're the one man band, or small team kind of set. You're probably on point for all customer contact. Like sometimes customers are badly behaved and you've got to lay the hard word down.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no doubt that, and I'm not naive to that in any way.
Sure.
What I always appreciated about you, Rocky, is when we'd ask you a question is like, should you do it like this, or how would you approach it? And your answer always started with, it depends, but you didn't stop there. You said, if, this is the situation, then this would be a better choice. If that was the situation, then this would be a better choice. You know what I mean? I mean, you mm-hmm. didn't fall for to do it this way all the time trap, which people want to hear. Because it makes they don't have to think about it, but you made people think about, the decisions that they make in their coding.
Well, that's at the end of the day, especially working as a consultant, I've never been the person in the consulting role where I had to live with that choice forever.
Right.
Right. The customer has to live with that choice. And so
right.
really the customer ought to be making an informed decision. Then they can live with their choice, hopefully now early in my career, before I got into consulting, I either was subject to the choices of my bosses. Sometimes they were good and sometimes not, or I became the person that was making those choices. And, And I certainly fell early on in my career. I fell for the, oh, that's shiny. I'm gonna do that just because it's shiny. And
right.
It was not the right choice. Right. It might have been fun, but yeah, then you live with the consequences. You know.
Yeah, I fell for that a couple of times too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just, but it's tough to also look at choices you're going to make and go, this is not, I'm not going to like this, but it's probably correct.
Right. Well, right.
Yeah. Blazer comes to mind, right? Because it's almost the boy who cried wolf for Microsoft, isn't it? I mean, of all the times that they've had these frameworks and this framework and that thing come out, and now they're like, no, really, this time it's really good. I promise. Right. And it took actually looking at it under the hood and understanding it for people such as yourself and other people that I really respect their opinions to come out and say, you know what, this is solid.
Yep. Yep. Well, and I hate to invoke it, but you know, I got suckered by Silverlight.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at that point in time, it was absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. From a developer's point of view anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But the architecture on which it was based, you know, being a plugin, you know, clearly, and that's where, like you said, you know, Blazor, and I still to this day, if it's not Blazor, it'll be some other WebAssembly framework.
Right.
Right. I mean, that at the end of the day, to me, that's the thing, is that WebAssembly almost certainly is the future of client-side computing.
Yeah. Unless one of the browser vendors, looking at you, Apple, decides I don't want to run WebAssembly anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a viable, you know, as Jobs did with Safari and plugins, although he happened to be right. When I do the history stories, as I do so often, you get a big nod. It's like, yeah, I know that sucked, but remember how every single family member had already replaced their address bar with some plugin they didn't know about?
Right.
Back in the day, I mean, banning plugins across the board ended that. Your address bar is really an address bar now.
Right. And the decision that you talk about in the future, if Apple decides to not support WebAssembly, I'd be hard pressed to find a good reason why.
Mm. It would have to be a security vulnerability, which ultimately what the add-in decision's best footing was. The fact that that Flash also killed the iPad battery might have had something to do with it.
Right.
But that's also because it was an inefficient piece of code built for desktops, not something designed for mobile. You know,
inefficient piece of what?
I was being polite.
Piece of what?
I'm being very polite. You know, you've got a Canadian and a Minnesotan on the show, right? We're going to be pretty polite.
That's exactly right.
Man, I'm a New Englander.
You're going to call it for what it is. In it. But admittedly, Flash was never meant to be in mobile, and it certainly we didn't run well that way.
Yeah.
And ultimately, to me, as the guy still working on the frickin' book, the sin of Silverlight was that Microsoft never admitted the truth and never built a bridge.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. They just, in fact, they never said anything. They just left us hanging.
Yep. And they could have left or created a bridge forward in
for sure
several different ways. And, chose to do nothing at all. Yeah. And that's exactly right.
That is a scar that's 10 years old and runs deep.
Yep.
Right.
Welcome to Three Old Guys Try to Talk.
But, you know, to your point about WASM, it's like the nice thing about WASM is that it all of the browsers have supported now. It's more likely that you'll fix the security vulnerability in WASM than abandon WASM.
Well, and by definition, WASM, WebAssembly, runs in a sandbox, and the only access it has to the DOM, which is how security vulnerabilities arise, is through one or two JavaScript methods.
Sure.
And that's it, right? So it would have to be pretty darn innovative to be able to attack a WebAssembly application.
It would represent a vulnerability in browsers, period, irrespective of that. Right.
It would be just as vulnerable in JavaScript.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think too, to the Apple point, it's actually a standard, right? Whereas, the plugin thing was a standard, but the plugins themselves weren't. And so arguably this is a different thing. It's like, right. this is just as much a part of browser standards as JavaScript is at this point. And so it's like, yeah, it'd be like Apple saying, well, we're not doing JavaScript anymore. Right.
Oh, that would be awesome. Actually, I would love that.
I mean, how many times have we seen movements towards getting away from JavaScript? You know, it's interesting. And in the end, like for better or worse, it's the assembly language of the web. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to write in assembly anymore.
Well, you know, there are other ways. It was the assembly language of the web, but now right. We actually have a real one. So
we have WebAssembly.
Yeah,
and hence the name. Getting back to this changing career side of things, Rocky, now we're coming into the end of this. How does Marimer evolve from here? Like, again, you're not that young. This is you for some period of time, but are you just going to stay on the projects and at some point wind it down? Like, what do you see as an outcome? Do you look that far in the future?
Yeah, I do. I I think you've pretty much summed it up. I think when I look forward, at some point I will want to retire and, mm-hmm. Spend my days fishing and whatever else. But I'm not ready to do that yet. That I guess is
No. And there is elegant ways to do that. And I point to our friend Bill Wagner, who had SRT was a serious practice with a bunch of partners. Mm-hmm. And as the partners hit different points in their careers, like it's time to end this. And they found homes for all their customers. Like I think he spent more than a year making sure all of his staff had a job, all of his clients had support, so that he was able to walk away with his head held high, didn't leave anybody in a lurch, and was able to go on to the next thing, which was supposed to be retirement, and somehow he ended up at Microsoft Docs.
I don't know. Right.
Thank God he did.
And thank God, Bill, because the Docs are better for you. You're our buddy. Thank you.
Are actually useful.
And HT Box would not have survived, would not have gotten to where it is today without Bill Wagner, just to put another plug in for Bill.
Right. Absolutely right. I look at that and I don't yet know, exactly what shape my intent is not to grow Marimer out to be, a staffing firm.
I'm a gen.
If I had wanted to do that, I would have done it when I was younger. But I don't want to run a big company. That's never been my desire. Right.
It's hard to sell a company when you're it, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
When it's just you, right? Like Franklin's Net is just me. There's no way I could sell that company because I come with it, you know?
Yeah. Right. And that just kind of defeats the purpose. It's like, you know what? I want to keep doing the job I've always done, but make it suck more. Can you do that?
Yeah.
Can you do that? That'd be awesome.
I look out, 10 years in the future. And I think, at that point, whatever customers I have, I'm going to need to find, somebody who can help them in a way that whatever I'm doing for them, right?
Yeah.
And I look at, CSLA or any other open source projects that I'm working on, and whether they end up being part of, like the .NET Foundation or, some other individual or group of people, become a leadership team, at different points in its history, CSLA has had, really vibrant core group of folks. And, but then, what I've observed having done this for over 20 years is that, people's real life careers move them along, right?
Right.
Like, Johnny Beckham from Norway is an example where, oh man, the contributions that he made to CSLA's rules engine. It is the way it is because of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moved on in his career, to a different type of role, and he doesn't do CSLA anymore. And so of course, he doesn't spend much time with CSLA, obviously.
Sure.
Right. And I don't blame him. That makes sense. But, So it is a little challenging to think about, how do you leave an open source project in a healthy state?
I guess it's got to be one of your missions now is to find that those contributors that can take on paying attention to it sometime in the future.
Right.
Grow them now.
Yep. Exactly.
You must have contributors. And well, you do. You must have a number one contributor.
Oh. Yep. Yep. Absolutely. And
there's this guy, Rockford Lockya.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, besides you.
Never.
Right, number two contributor.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And that's my point, Carl, is over the years that number two contributor has changed.
Yeah.
You know, several times. And, but I look at like CSLA 6, the release we just came out with. Geez, I guess I'd have to count, but I think there was close to 40 people that contributed.
Awesome. Wow.
I mean, it's fantastic. And I enjoy that. Yeah. You know, whether it's people that have really dug in and do big contributions or, and especially now, you know, talking about the career change, I have more flexibility, to, I guess, mentor. You know, I've had a couple people, they're like, well, I'd love to contribute, but I don't even know how to do a pull request. And I'm like, well, let's get on Discord and I'll walk you through the process.
Or write a blog post.
Well, I have. I've got what I think are good blog posts and good documentation, but you know, sometimes, you know, just half an hour of spending, you know, getting on a audio or video chat. Mm-hmm.
I agree.
And walking, you know, that's all it takes. And then all of a sudden the dam breaks, right? And it's like, you know, then they're like, oh, I get it. And now I'll contribute more stuff.
He gets it. I get it. Rocky, is there anything else that we didn't cover that you want to talk about? Anything you want to plug?
Well, just my normal CSLA stuff, probably.
I put the link in. Congratulations on version 6.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun. And now we're already working on the next stuff. So it's I love it.
It's amazing. After you know, Jesus, pushing in, 10 plus years.
And, 20, well, the .NET 20? Version came
out. Yeah,
the .NET version. The overall, it's pushing 25 years. So.
25 years. And still features needed to be built.
Yep.
Doing Blazor and or Maui these days, are you staying current with it?
Well, I personally am still doing a lot of Blazor. But CSLA 6.1 added support for Maui. So I did jump into a bunch of Maui stuff.
So here's a question for you, Mr. XAML. Do you prefer Maui XAML or Maui Blazor?
Aha.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so
it depends.
It depends, but really what it boils down to, I think, Carl, and what sold me on Blazor and HTML and stuff is I think XAML is better designed, right? As a language, it's better architected, but HTML and CSS, you can go to Richard's point, I can go on Google, I can say, hey, here's my problem, and I can find several different snippets of HTML or CSS,
right?
And I can figure out which one seems to fit my need and copy paste it in. And you don't do that with XAML.
No, you can't. You don't even understand it, what somebody's saying.
And so at the end of the day, as much as I really do like XAML, HTML CSS is the more productive option.
Yeah, I agree. And the Blazor component model just makes it so easy to do stuff like binding and eventing, way easier than XAML.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense, right? Because you look and say, well, it's the culmination of learnings from VB6 to Windows Forms to Web Forms to XAML.
And the browser already being a cross-platform. Yeah. Thing.
Yep. Yep. You know, all those different ways that at least Microsoft has tried to do data binding and event binding and component models over, you know, decades. And, you know, not to say that Blazor's there might be something better in the future, but the model that it has is by far the best they've come up with so far.
Absolutely. Yeah. It took a guy like Steve Sanderson to simplify it.
Yep. Right.
And make it that powerful. Wow. All right. Well, we're in violent agreement here.
Yeah. It's a damn shame we don't get along.
I know. It's a shame.
Yeah. We should argue more or something.
Well, Rocky, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you. It's always a pleasure talking to you. And good
Likewise.
Luck on your new venture.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you, guys.
Good to talk to you, friends.
Yep. And we'll see you next time on .NET Rocks.
.NET Rocks is brought to you by Franklin's Net and produced by Plop Studios, a full-service audio, video, and post-production facility located physically in New London, Connecticut, and of course in the cloud. Online at pwop.com. Visit our website at dotnetrocks.com for RSS feeds, downloads, mobile apps, comments, and access to the full archives going back to show number one, recorded in September 2002. And make sure you check out our sponsors. They keep us in business. Now go write some code. See you next time. Got transmitter bands by the FCC. Yes, I'm a toy boy. Life is hard. Pay my taxes with my credit card.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.